Good afternoon, Your Honors. If it pleases the court, my name is Gary Benson, registration number 19681. I'm here today on behalf of Ingham Enterprises. Thank you so much for taking the time to hear our case today. I'd like to give you a brief summary of the facts of this lawsuit before we delve into the deep legal issues relating to the economic loss doctrine. This is a lawsuit that arises out of the explosion of a 5-foot-tall steel tank containing anhydrous ammonia. And it happened at the plaintiff's, Engerman's, cold storage facility in June of 2008. The gas is inside this 5-foot-tall tank when merely sitting at rest at ambient room temperature in the Engerman engine room began to expand, and within one day, the tank could not contain the pressure any longer and ruptured, shooting through the engine room like a torpedo and releasing deadly ammonia gases into the engine room. Luckily, this all happened on a Saturday. There was no loss of life, only significant damage to the Engerman facility and property, requiring days of hazmat cleanup, closing down of Interstate 25, subsequent remediation efforts over longer periods of time. Our client, Mr. Engerman, Engerman Enterprises, filed suit for the damages that it sustained and brought three claims for relief: negligence, vicarious liability, respondeat superior because of the technician who was servicing the engine room, and a negligent supervision claim. The district court granted summary judgment exactly 1 year ago today, holding that the economic loss rule prevented Engerman from pursuing any of its tort claims, as the trial court found that because a contract existed between the parties, either expressed or implied, there was some potential argument either way that the contract precluded the tort claims. There was another party to this lawsuit, and that was Fireman's Fund Insurance Company. They settled their claims against Tolan for the monies that they had paid to Engerman for a portion of its property damages shortly before the court ruled on the motion for summary judgment. I'm happy to entertain any questions that you have today. I would, however, like to focus my limited time before the court on the question of whether Tolan's handling of anhydrous ammonia created an independent tort duty to Engerman to exercise the highest degree of care, and whether Engerman's allegations of willful and wanton conduct create exceptions to the economic loss rule. The economic loss rule provides that a party suffering only economic loss from a breach of an express or implied contractual duty may not assert a tort claim for such a breach absent an independent duty of care under tort law. While the rule was intended to save contract law from drowning in a sea of tort, as I noted in a law review journal I read in preparing for today's argument out of Rutgers in 2006, it's our position that we're now faced with the need to protect tort law from the tort-eating monster that has become the economic loss rule. If this case, the Engerman case, does not involve an independent tort duty owed by Tolan to Engerman, then we believe the exception to the economic loss rule has been extinguished. While we could find no Colorado authority directly on point in regard to whether there is a higher independent duty of care in the handling of anhydrous ammonia, our Supreme Court in Blue Flame Gas versus Van Hoos, which is cited in our briefs, cited with approval a Nebraska case imposing the highest degree of standard of care on suppliers of anhydrous ammonia fertilizer. In granting summary judgment, the trial court acknowledged that due to the dangerous nature of ammonia, while not sufficient to impose strict liability, its handling warranted a degree of care higher than that for numerous other substances, and cited to the, I'm going to butcher this, Mwajon versus Public Service case. And that case imposed the highest degree of care applicable to dangerous materials. In this case, Tolan's service and refrigerant reports have boilerplate language on the back that require Tolan to perform in a prudent and workmanlike manner, which is akin to ordinary and reasonable care. And we believe that standard is entirely different than the highest degree of care standard that the trial court and Engerman agree should be imposed. But what the trial court did next in granting summary judgment, Your Honors, is what we believe eviscerates the exception to the economic loss rule. It held that contract law would impose this higher degree of care if the contract standard of care didn't apply. It stated that it would simply rewrite the higher standard of care. The trial court effectively held there'd be no independent delivery duty. So if the back of this refrigerant report said, we're going to do things in a prudent and workmanlike manner, the court said, but if the actual standard of care is higher, we will simply imply that and read that on to the back of the terms, and we contract law will take care of this.
Well, let's talk about that for a minute, counsel, if I may. You have conceded that whatever the terms of, that there was a contract that was formed of some kind.
We've used the word repeatedly that there are refrigerant agreements, there are service agreements, and they are the standard agreements you would expect in a situation like this with some boilerplate language on the back.
Okay, so what the trial court concluded was that there was some kind of a contract, whether it was an implied contract or one of those contracts.
Correct.
But you concede there was a contract.
There was, those agreements did exist, Your Honor.
Okay. And you also concede that whatever contract you had required a reasonable duty of care.
Yes, a prudent workmanlike, which we equate to reasonable, correct.
Okay, so now we have this Colorado Supreme Court case called Imperial Distribution Services versus Forrest, which is a Justice Quinn opinion from the Supreme Court in 1987. And that case talks about how, and that was a tort case, okay? But it says that when you've got a reasonable degree of care in a tort case, what that means is the greater the risk, the greater the amount of care that's required to avoid injury to other workers. So in other words, even if the duty is reasonable care means reasonable care under the circumstances, reasonable care commensurate to the risk.
A floating standard that could change based on the circumstances.
Correct. So we also have some case law that indicates that when you're looking at contracts that have a reasonable duty of care, that you read them the same way as what the tort duty would be. In other words, so why wouldn't we take a look at these contracts that have a reasonable duty of care and say that because this substance was hazardous, then the reasonable duty of care that was in those contracts is to use the care that was commensurate with the risk.
Well, it is our position that, and I apologize, I'm not familiar with the 1988 case that you read, but it's our position that there is a distinction between these two standards of care.
But why should there be? And for example, you have constantly have contracts for disposal of hazardous waste. Let's put it that way. All right?
Yes.
We know these exist.
Absolutely.
To my knowledge, I have never seen one in all the years that I was practicing that says that there is anything other that imposes any sort of a duty of care higher than a reasonable duty of care. And yet, if we were to take your rule, I think what it would mean is that all those contracts are subject to being superseded by tort law requiring the highest duty of care. Wouldn't that tear apart all hazardous waste disposal contracts?
Well, I'm not here on behalf of all the hazardous waste disposal cases, but I am here for this case, and it is our position, right or wrong, wherever we fall on this, we have to be consistent in our position, and our position is that there is a heightened duty of care, and as it relates to your hypothetical, that does this not throw all of those hazardous cases on their head? As it relates to the economic loss rule, perhaps it does. Perhaps it does. We're sitting here with an expectation argument. It is beyond the expectation of Engman Enterprises, Your Honor, that three bombs would be placed in their engine room. These bombs were not placed there as part of the service. It's a but-for scenario, Your Honor. These bombs were there because they were servicing the refrigerant system under a service agreement. However, it wasn't the service of the cooling system that caused this problem. It was an untrained, unsupervised technician who left three bombs in my client's engine room that were ticking and at some point were going to explode and eventually did explode. It wasn't the contemplation of the parties, either Tolan or Engman, at the time that this occurred, that somebody is going to leave three bombs. I would say it's akin to, well, we're going to use, it's a but-for, we're going to service, so we're going to get off the hook for anything we do to your client. So if my driver is drunk and is coming out to service and drives right through your facility because he's drunk, you know, we have an economic loss rule argument because the back of our service agreement says, we're sorry. You know, you're limited to the following damages. It could not have been within the contemplation of the parties that the drunk driver service technician is going to drive through. Similarly, it was never within the contemplation of Engelman, or I would posit anybody in this situation, that the service technician, unrelated to the service, is going to leave three torpedoes in his engine room. And so when I come back to your excellent question was, does this heightened standard of care give rise to an exception to the economic loss rule? We're left with the position that we're going to stand firm behind the argument that this could never have been the contemplation of the parties. There is an independent duty here, heightened in our position, our view, and it is different than that which is set forth explicitly on the back of this service agreement, which is we specifically promise to do something in a prudent and workmanlike manner.
And if there was I'm not going too wildly outside the record here, but if there had been just a complaint for breach of contract, forget the limitation on liability, wouldn't you certainly be arguing to the jury that prudent and workmanlike and reasonable in this contractual sense means, reasonable is fact-based depending on what's reasonable under the circumstances. And certainly when you're dealing with super hazardous materials like this, reasonable means more than if you're just transporting loads of concrete. I'm trying to understand.
I think that's a fair point, Your Honor. What I would say is that if that was the case, there is no need for any of the various authorities, the Nebraska case cited by the Colorado Supreme Court case, which created heightened standards beyond reasonable. The fact is that there is authority out there, and there are courts that have held and distinguished between reasonable and these heightened authority, the heightened standard of care. In my stand on my feet, try to think fast, and I want to reserve a little bit of time and take a knee. But nonetheless, in answer to your question, I think that there would be no need for these heightened standards of care if reasonable and workmanlike and prudent were sufficient to impose a duty that would govern any specific type of conduct.
Counsel, before you take a knee.
Yes, Your Honor.
Had you brought a breach of contract claim, could you not have recovered the exact same damages under consequential damages category?
Well, there are also limitation of damages clauses on the boilerplate language on the back that limited the recovery that was available to our client. So if we are stuck with the contract, we are then stuck with the limitations that are imposed upon us by that contract. And the judge below said we could have argued that that was unconscionable and made a variety of arguments, but we could have brought a breach of contract claim, but we would have been governed by a limitation of damage clause. If you want your cake, you got to eat it too. And if we think there's a contract, those contract terms were much more onerous and would not have allowed us to recover the damage we're seeking at trial.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. April Moore, registration number 38313, representing Tolan Mechanical Systems. May it please the Court? The economic loss rule serves to ensure the predictability in commercial transactions, such as the transaction between Engelman Enterprises and Tolan Mechanical Systems, which is the subject of this appeal. The Colorado Supreme Court said it best in the Town of Alma versus ASCO. The law serves to encourage parties to confidently allocate risks and costs during their bargaining without fear that unanticipated liability, such as a tort claim at issue here, may arise in the future. Here, it is undisputed that both Engelman Enterprises and Tolan Mechanical are sophisticated commercial businesses. In fact, the parties entered into a contract for Tolan to sell Engelman ammonia, which was to be added to Engelman's cooling system by Tolan's employees. And they had entered into similar contracts for approximately 4 years prior to the ammonia incident. Since the parties entered into a commercial contract for the provision and installation of ammonia, Inkerman Enterprises should be required to seek redress for its damages through contract rather than tort law. In this particular case, the application of the economic loss rule is significant. As you are aware, tort actions have significant advantages over breach of contract claims. Specifically in this case, it allows the availability of punitive damages.
Counsel, let me back you up for just a second. Something you said a moment ago about the two parties negotiating at arm's length. In this case, didn't the agreement that you presented to them indicate that consequential damages would not be available?
Yes, that is correct, Your Honor. But as indicated, the parties have been using similar contracts for 4 years. During the year prior to this incident, there were indeed 30 different contracts that went back and forth between the parties. At any point, if Inkerman Enterprises had objected to the terms of that contract, it could have requested different terms. However, at no point did it request any different terms, and therefore agreed to the fact that it would thereby preclude itself from receiving consequential damages such as loss of income.
So would you agree with your counterpart then that had they pursued only a contract claim that they would have been limited in their damages?
Their damages would have been slightly limited, Your Honor. In fact, the loss of the future earnings potentially would have been limited by that. However, the other damages were not limited. The repairs of the facility were all included within the contractual claim, such as including the salaries to the employees subsequent for the repairs and also for the hazmat cleanup, would have all been included within the contractual claim.
So is it my understanding that even though consequential damages were to some extent limited by the terms of the contract, that there still were certain of what would normally be considered consequential damages that would be permitted even under the contract that they entered into?
Yes, Your Honor. For instance, all of the damage that they're claiming to the building, all the repairs to the building, and anything that arose as a result of that would have been included under the contract. And those damages would have been provided if they had pursued a contractual claim.
What part of the contract would I look at in order to see that?
Your Honor, if you look at the back page of the refrigeration report or the service agreement, there's a limitation of damages section that provides what would be provided as damages in the event of a situation such as this.
But that says Tolo's liability for defective labor or workmanship shall be limited to the repair of same.
Correct.
So, I mean, that seems pretty narrow to me. And you're saying, what other damages could they recover other than simply repairing what was broken as a result of their...
Well, Your Honor, you need to keep this in context. So this is a large-scale commercial refrigeration facility. Tolo was responsible for the ammonia cooling system, which is essentially the whole system there. So when they're repairing a portion of the system, they're working on the entire system. So any damages to that small portion of the system would also inherently include the entire system. So the repairs that they're requesting would have been included under the contract.
Well, let me ask another question. Let's assume, just for purposes of my question, that the contract that you entered into would limit some of the types of consequential damages that they might want to recover. Does that implicate how and whether the economic loss rule gets applied in any event?
No, Your Honor. I think the case law is clear, and specifically referring to the City of Westminster versus Centric Jones Constructors. It specifically provides that consequential property damages are within the scope of the economic loss rule, in that the damages to the property itself are within the scope of the rule, and then also any damages that are consequential directly from that breach also fall within it. Here, I believe that any damage to the facility as a result of the ammonia exposure are similar consequential damages.
So I'm still having trouble with Alma's definition of economic loss as damages other than physical harm to persons or property. What does that mean?
Your Honor, since that time, the case laws continue to expand. But going back to the town of Alma specifically, the court goes on further to state that although it's deemed as the economic loss rule, it's actually more correctly defined as the independent duty rule. Whether or not there's a duty that falls outside of the contract. And in this case, the duty was from the contract, therefore it cannot be intended. Therefore, the actual crux of this case is not whether or not there's economic loss, but whether or not there's an independent duty, in which there's not.
So the language I read is just kind of loose language?
Yes, Your Honor, and if you go on further, it does indeed state that. And Your Honor, I also direct your attention to an ERW Inc., which also provides that this crux of the case is whether or not the duty is independent and not whether or not there's an economic loss, which is another Colorado Supreme Court case.
So what are we to make of the Colorado Supreme Court's Blue Flame decision where, now granted, they're talking about other examples, not the issue right in front of them, but they say there are other substances that, due to the gravity of the risk created by them, require an enhanced measure of care on the part of distributors. See example, the Herman v. Midland, Nebraska case, and they put in Quran, explosive potential of anhydrous ammonia fertilizer calls for highest degree of care by supplier.
Your Honor, I call your attention once again to the case that was cited by Judge Terry, Imperial Colorado Supreme Court case, which provides that the reasonable degree of care is what's reasonable under the circumstances. The additional heightened degree of care is unnecessary in that it's already applied. A similar situation arose before the Texas Colorado Supreme Court in that their heightened degree of care was required. However, what that court stated was that the degree is what's reasonable for those engaged in similar services. There was an oil well drilling, here it's ammonia provision of services. Similarly, the heightened degree of care is already provided by the reasonable degree. The heightened degree that's requested by Ingeman is unnecessary because it's already required pursuant to the contract.
Okay.
Your Honors, I'd like to take this moment to address a few of the other issues that arose in plaintiff's appeal. Specifically, the plaintiff's, Ingeman Enterprises request that...
I'm sorry, my clock is not working. I don't know how much time...
Oh, it just went out. Yeah.
Well,
it's still running at 6 minutes and 15 seconds.
Okay.
Thank you.
Oh, would you let us know when it gets down to 2 minutes, for instance? Okay. Go ahead. Sorry about that.
Thank you, Your Honor. In regards to the negligent supervision claim, I'd like to address that briefly, and specifically that obviously the economic loss rule must apply to negligent supervision claims in that a negligent supervision claim is framed exclusively in tort, as stated by the trial court judge in this case. It would be illogical to apply the economic loss rule to a negligence claim for Tone's actions due to the installation of ammonia, but later to bar that same application just because you pled negligent supervision. And while this issue has not been directly addressed in Colorado, it has been addressed by other jurisdictions, such as the Georgia Court of Appeals affirming a summary judgment on an economic loss rule where negligent supervision is alleged, and also a similar ruling by Ohio Court of Appeals. The Ohio Court of Appeals specifically provided there's no distinction in appellant's claims of negligence and negligent supervision.
Didn't the reply brief, in fact, point out that that Georgia case didn't involve a claim for negligent supervision of employees? Would you agree with that?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
However, the Ohio Court of Appeals specifically does have similar facts in that, and it does provide that negligent and negligent supervision, there's no distinction. Thus, Tolan requests that the court apply the economic loss rule to the negligent supervision claim. Additionally, I'd like to lastly address the willful and wanton conduct claim in that it's irrelevant to the application of the economic loss rule in this case. First of all, I'd like the court to recognize that there's not a tribal issue of fact of whether or not Tolan's conduct was willful and wanton. Specifically, Ingman has already requested the trial court in this case to find that the complaint should be amended to add punitive damages. However, the court denied this amendment, finding that there was not even a tribal issue of fact on whether Tolan's conduct was willful and wanton. Additionally, even if Tolan's conduct was willful and wanton, which is not, Colorado case law has already provided that whether or not a tort is intentional, it doesn't affect the applicability of the economic loss rule. And that occurred in Hammond Contractors versus Carter and Burgess. Similarly, the Court of Appeals in Colorado applied the economic loss rule in U.S. Fire Insurance Company, even though there were claims of willful and wanton breach of contract. In summary, it's clear, based upon the undisputed evidence, the parties entered into a contract for the provision and installation of ammonia. It was the actions of Tolan under this contract that resulted in the release of ammonia and Ingman's alleged damages. The contract provided for the duty. It arose for the duty regardless of whether or not there was an express contract or an implied contract. The court is required to infer those terms that are not already provided, and here the court would indeed infer that there was a duty to act reasonably under the circumstances. Based upon that, there is not an independent duty because Tolan was already required to perform its duties as required by the contract. Therefore, the economic loss rule must be applied, and the trial court order dismissing Ingman's tort claims must be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
So, Bailiff, how much time do we have left?
1 minute and 41 seconds.
Thank you. Got it.
Got it, Your Honors. A couple of points in rebuttal. In regards to your issue regarding damages and the scope of damages, there is a significant limitation of the damages under the exculpatory limitation clause on the back of these refrigerant reports. It is to repair, as you said, the damage caused. It's to repair the coolant system. There is millions of dollars of food in the cooling areas that I do not believe, and I certainly anticipate that Tolan would have argued was not covered by the limitation of damages because of the limitation of damages clause on the back of the contract. In addition, I'm going to take a shot, Judge Terry. I've had an opportunity to consult with counsel, so I'm not going to take all the credit for this, but on your issue about the impact of this on all of the hazardous material cases that are out there, what I would say, the distinction is that this is not and was not a case about the handling of hazardous materials. This is a case about servicing a refrigeration system. There was no known or contemplated understanding by my client, Ingman, that this case involved the handling and the potential inclusion of bombs in his engine room. So in order to alleviate your concern that perhaps this will have a wide-ranging impact on all of these known hazardous material cases, I don't believe that would apply.
And counsel, your time is up.
Perfect.
Thank you. Thank you both for your very fine arguments. We apologize for the problem with the clock there toward the end. And with that, this case will stand submitted.